From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, September 17th, 2025. Maine Secretary of State Shenna Bellows today questioned the motives behind a new lawsuit by the U.S. Department of Justice aimed at forcing the state to turn over voter registration data for every resident. As Steve Missler reports, at least 27 states are fighting similar requests, but only Maine and Oregon have been sued.
The DOJ lawsuit filed in federal district court says the months-long effort to obtain driver's license numbers, partial Social Security numbers, partisan affiliation, and voting frequency is part of a larger effort to ensure the state is properly maintaining voter rolls. But voting rights groups like the Brennan Center for Justice warn that the effort is part of the Trump administration's bid to take over federal elections and amass a database of personal information for every voter in the country. Bellows voiced similar concerns at a press briefing on Wednesday.
The Department of Justice, which has the ability to investigate people and put them in jail, should not have the right to know the partisan affiliation of every single voter in the country. That's not something they've ever had.
While some states have provided some publicly available voting information, most are fighting the requests, including states with Republican election officials. The Office of Maine Attorney General will represent Bellows in the lawsuit, but had not responded to the DOJ's complaint as of Wednesday afternoon. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine questioned fired U.S. CDC Director Susan Menares today during a Senate Health Committee hearing. Menares testified that U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired her because she refused to dismiss career CDC vaccine officials, and she said she also refused to pre-approve recommendations from a federal vaccine advisory committee without evaluating scientific evidence. Collins asked Menares about the potential public health consequences of relying on political staff rather than career scientists. Menares responded that it puts children's health at risk.
It puts at risk others who need these vaccines, and it takes us into a very dangerous place in public health.
Menares was fired in August after just 29 days in her role. The Senate hearing was aimed at restoring, quote, radical transparency at the CDC. With open enrollment to buy health coverage for 2026 just weeks away, health advocates are increasing pressure on Congress to extend enhanced premium tax credits that will expire at the end of the year. Ann Woolison, Executive Director of Consumers for Affordable Healthcare, says 54,000 Mainers receive the enhanced subsidies through the online marketplace, and without them, many will no longer be able to afford coverage.
Counties in northern and downeast Maine, including Aroostook and Washington County, have the highest potential increase in premiums, around 70% or more.
Woolison says when people can't afford health insurance, they often delay care, which ultimately increases costs for other consumers and providers. Senate candidate Graham Plattner says he raised more than $2.5 million during the first month of his campaign as he seeks to challenge Republican Senator Susan Collins next fall. Plattner created a buzz last month with his blunt attacks on Collins and his anti-establishment tone. The oysterman and veteran from Sullivan is one of eight Democrats vying for the party's nomination, but Plattner already appears to be outpacing his best-funded opponent, Jordan Wood of Bristol, in the competition for donations. Governor Janet Mills, meanwhile, is still weighing her own potential Senate bid. Maine's Senate race is expected to be one of the most expensive and closely watched elections in the country next year. The city of Sanford is the latest town in Maine to adopt a temporary moratorium on rent increases for mobile home lots. City councilors last night cited reports from residents who said their lot rents had more than doubled over the last 5 years, presenting a financial crisis for some. The moratorium is in place until mid-December. In the meantime, city councilors say they will consider a model ordinance that a statewide working group is in the process of drafting for municipalities. Earlier this month, the city of Waterville adopted a similar moratorium. Maine's largest public drinking water supplies are contaminated with hexavalent chromium, arsenic or nitrate, or all three chemicals combined. That's according to a new national study and interactive map published by the Environmental Working Group. Sydney Evans is a senior science analyst with the nonprofit and co-author of the report.
Hexavalent chromium nationally has no standard, even though we know it is toxic at pretty low levels. And it's kind of hard to treat for. It requires one of these advanced treatment methods to get rid of it.
And Evans says those same advanced technologies also filter out arsenic and nitrate. The EPA typically evaluates the cost-benefit of treating each drinking water contaminant on its own, but the report concludes that if all three chemicals were screened and treated together, an estimated 50,000 cancer cases could be prevented nationwide. A link to the group's full report and the interactive map showing contaminated water supplies can be found in this story at mainpublic.org. The arrest of a parent near a Portland elementary school by ICE agents last week has focused attention on how President Trump's enforcement agenda could affect immigrant students and families. The Portland City Council last week passed a resolution calling for more transparency from federal law enforcement agencies. To better understand the legal questions at play here, I spoke with attorney Max Brooks from the American Civil Liberties Union of Maine, which recently published a back-to-school guide for immigrant families and other groups.
Immigrant families still have a basic right to a public education under the Equal Protection Clause and under Supreme Court precedent. And there's related rights that folks should not be required to have to provide certain documents like their birth certificates to show residency to be able to go to public schools. And there's lots families can do kind of on their own to just prepare for the possibility of an arrest, where you kind of record different information about maybe bank accounts or about passwords or about where certain documents are kept, so that if the worst were to happen and if there were an arrest by ICE, you wouldn't be scrambling to do some of the most useful things that would be good to have in place ahead of time. So we encourage families that are worried about something like this to go ahead and complete like a family preparedness plan and make sure they're doing as much as they can ahead of time to be in as good a position as possible if the worst does happen.
So what kind of information can schools request about students' immigration status or their residency?
So school districts cannot ask about a student's citizenship or immigration status as proof of the student's residency within a district. They can, you know, ask for a birth certificate, but you have the right to withhold that, or you have the right to provide alternate documents that prove what your age is that may not reveal as much about your immigration status.
Should families be concerned at all about their information that they file with the school district ending up in the hands of the federal government?
There's no absolute guarantee that, you know, a ICE agent couldn't get, you know, a judicial warrant to try to get information from a school district, and a school district would have to abide by a valid judicial warrant. But there are policies that school districts can put in place, like insisting on a judicial warrant to provide that kind of information, or not collecting certain kinds of information when other information would serve the same purpose, that make it less likely that something like that would happen.
So to the point of federal agents accessing school property, are ICE agents allowed to enter schools and school grounds? You know, under what circumstances would federal agents be allowed on campus?
It's a bit of a complicated question, but it's certainly clearer that federal agents would not have access to non-public areas of a school if the school did not consent to their accessing those areas and if it was really clear what those areas were. Now, if ICE were to obtain a warrant, a judicial warrant, they would likely would have the ability to enter the school grounds. But short of that, if they were to have just an administrative warrant, a warrant that they issue internally, which is often what an ICE warrant is, that is not something that a school district would have to honor to allow that officer into non-public areas of the school.
So I guess one thing I'm taking away here is that a lot of this does depend on the individual district and what information they collect.
Yeah, so school districts themselves can create policies that are more protective or less protective of the immigrant families in their district. And so folks within these communities can research what policies their schools do have and advocate for better policies if they don't like what the existing policies are.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainpublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 tomorrow morning, seafood from the deck to the dining room. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.